Hello everyone, and welcome to A Wish Come Clear's You Need to Read video series. And today I am just bouncing off the walls excited to be talking to Anna Kunicki. Anna is a Martha Beck certified master life coach, speaker, and a writer at DeclareDominion.com. She is a self-proclaimed heathen mystic, and she helps women to declare dominion over their gorgeous lives. She is also at work on a memoir that I cannot wait to read. I think our memoirs should be best friends. So, welcome, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
This is just, yes, I'm giddy. There's a giddy excitement today that I get to talk to you. So to get started, I just want to help people get to know you and the work that you do.
Yeah.
So what does it mean to do, as your website tagline says, to declare dominion over your gorgeous life? And how did you get started with writing about that?
Well, so for a while, I have actually been choosing a theme for my year. I'm an English major. I need metaphors and themes and all kinds of that good stuff. And so this was quite a few years ago. I chose the word dominion as my theme for the year. And it was because actually I wasn't declaring dominion over anything at that point. I had a very young daughter. She was still a baby. I was working. I had like two kind of simultaneous careers that I was pushing forward at the same time. And everything felt completely out of control. And I was attracted to this word dominion because I was like, I don't even have a dominion. I'm just like this spinning ball of chaos. I don't have like a space that's mine, and I certainly wasn't taking responsibility or taking charge of my world. And so this word dominion, it echoed through me, and it felt like maybe there would be a chance to make life not just survivable, but maybe even a little bit beautiful, maybe even a little bit mysterious and wonderful. And that word dominion as my theme for that year was such a powerful force in my life. It became sort of a guiding principle. And I realized that what had happened was I had become almost completely reactive, where I just was, you know, something would happen, something would explode, and I'd deal with that, or something would catch on fire, and I would put out that fire. But I didn't really have any sort of a vision or a sense of how I wanted to steer my life or the person I wanted to be. And so this word dominion was so powerful for me that then, over the next few years, as I trained with Dr. Martha Beck and became a life coach and started my own practice, I realized that what I really wanted to do was to help women declare dominion. And, you know, we'll be probably talking a lot about things that we've been taught, but I feel like as girls and as women, we're not necessarily taught to do that. You know, we're taught be sweet, be nice, be kind, be a hard worker, get all the gold stars. We're taught all kinds of things. But it's like there's this really important piece missing, at least in my upbringing, which was that my life is my dominion. It is mine. And it is my job and my responsibility to make with it what I will. And so it was a really powerful way for me to claim my own life and claim responsibility for it and start to make really deliberate and powerful choices about that.
I love it. I mean, the first time I saw that when I visited your website, I think probably found through Martha Beck and the whole wonderful network of coaches. And I remember seeing those words and just thinking, ooh, that's wonderful. Like, declare dominion. And I obviously kind of resonated with the kind of the biblical overtones of like, you know, God's looking out on the world and like, oh, this is my dominion and everything. But yes, I love that idea of having to learn to step into your own power.
Yeah, and the gorgeous comes in because I think we get to choose whether we're going to make our lives gorgeous or not. And it doesn't mean that my life is always gorgeous by any stretch. I have five kids now, and so life is, you know, over the top crazy a lot of the time. But I do think that whether you live in a big, you know, traditionally gorgeous mansion or you live in a teeny tiny little studio, we still have choices that we can make. And you know, you can still choose to put flowers in that tiny studio, or you can choose to dress beautifully even if you're your budget is limited. And so it's an important way for me to remind myself that no matter what the circumstances are, we can always make them a little bit more gorgeous.
That's perfect. And I love how you highlighted the power of choice there, because my next question is talking about the idea that the words we use really matter a lot and really carry a lot of weight and significance. Mm-hmm. And in your free offering, you talk about the 5 phrases to banish from your vocabulary and the 5 That's... to use instead. What words are you going to choose? So Could you talk about a couple of those for us and explain why those word choices are powerful?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, this is a free guide that's available on my website at declaredominion.com. And it came from realizing that I was living in this constant state of victimhood. And that, it sounds dramatic to call it victimhood, but it was. I lived in a land of shoulds, have to's, wish I had, and can'ts. Mm-hmm. I realized that I was saying things like, I can't do this, or I have to do this, like many, many, many times a day, dozens of times, maybe even 100 times a day. And I started to realize that those words actually had a lot of power in my life. They made me feel really trapped and powerless. I have to put the baby down for a nap. I have to go to work. I have to do laundry. I have to pay my bills. I have to, And the weird thing was I realized that I was using it even about things that were actually kind of fun. Like, oh, I have to go meet my friend for lunch, or I have to, go see my parents. These are actually wonderful treats. And yet somehow my language was turning them into just one more thing on my to-do list to tick off. Mm. And I started to think about this and I was like, I wonder how much of an impact this is having on me. So I did a little bit of an experiment where I first started with the words can't and have to.
Okay.
I tried to banish them from my vocabulary. And oh my gosh, you guys, you should try this. It is so hard.
It is, truly.
It's so hard. Once you start to tune in, you realize that we say these phrases all the time. And once you start to kind of become a little bit more sensitized to it, you will realize that the people around you see them all the time.
Yes.
Too. And it's sort of kind of funny once you sort of, once it's on your radar, you'll be like, oh my gosh, everyone, they literally walk around going, I can't do this. I have to do this. I should do this. I wish I had done that. And, it's kind of wild. And so I did this experiment where I just started shifting my language. I didn't do anything else differently. I just shifted the way I was speaking. Mm. And so I tried to banish the words can't and have to. There are a few others, juicy ones that you can also, put the ixnay on, and that is also helpful too. But those are, I think, the two big ones. And I realized that every time I'd be like, I'm going to go get groceries, or, oh, I have to go, pick up the, I'm going to go pick up whatever it was. Or instead of saying, yeah, I can't go to that tonight, I would say, you know what? I'm afraid I won't be there tonight. And it's a subtle shift. It's not a huge shift, but it is incredibly powerful. Because what it did was it gave me my power back. It put me back in that driver's seat. And it made me reckon with the fact that many places in my life where I thought I was sort of powerless, I felt trapped by all of my shoulds and have to's and can'ts. The truth is, I actually had a huge amount of choice and of power. I just wasn't exercising it. So I was choosing not to exercise my own power. And when I shifted my language, what happened was that it shifted my story. Ooh. And what we're learning, more and more about the mind and the brain all the time is that we live our lives telling ourselves narratives. Literally, the way that we move through the world, we're not just taking in raw data. We're shaping it all the time into a narrative that we tell ourselves in our minds. And these narratives are incredibly powerful because they literally shape the way that we experience the world. Mm. And what happened when I shifted that story by just shifting these tiny little bits of speech was that I shifted my narrative. So instead of being a woman who was so trapped, by this baby to take care of and the fact that I needed to make enough money and I had obligations or I had made commitments, instead of feeling like I was a victim to those choices or those, you know, circumstances, it made me really take responsibility for the fact that those were the choices I wanted to make. I didn't want to walk away from my baby. Of course not, right? Like, that wasn't something, but you could do that. Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to go to work. Maybe I didn't feel good in the moment, but if I considered, like, well, what would it mean if I just didn't show up to work today? Oh, actually, no, I'd much rather go get a paycheck. Thank you very much, you know?
Sure.
And so it was kind of a radical reckoning with the fact that we all have immense, you know, spectrum of choices in front of us all the time. You could just choose to stop paying your bills. You could do that. Probably not going to get you great results. You could, right? People walk away from their families. They walk away from their commitments all the time. And the fact that we choose day in and day out not to do that, that we choose to take care of our families and keep our commitments to our loved ones and, you know, be faithful with our promises, I think that that is a beautiful and wonderful thing. And just by shifting your language, you can really start to take ownership of that.
Yes, yes. So many thoughts on this. First, that I too am an English major and my love language is words of affirmation. So this goes straight to my heart. Mm. Secondly, the first story that I tell in the current draft of my book, which is just, you know, in draft form, but
exciting. Oh my gosh.
Thank you. Thank you. It's walking to school with my mom. This is one of my very earliest memories. And I got some mud on my t-shirt. Like, there were these little mud dots, and I kind of freaked out because at, you know, 6 or 7 or whenever this was, it was just like, oh my God, the other kids are going to see it and it's going to be bad. And oh my God, like, I was already kind of anxious. And I said to my mom, you know, please, can we go home? I have to change. I have mud on my shirt. And she was like, we really can't go home and change right now. And I was like, but I'm dying. And her response was incredibly clever. She doesn't remember this, but I really clearly do. So she said, okay, honey, how about this? Why don't you pretend that those mud dots are jewels? Why don't you make up a story? And I was like, ooh, okay. And so I made up this story in my head about how I was a princess and how these mud dots might have appeared to everyone else as dots, but secretly they were jewels and only I could see them and like all this stuff.
Love it. Oh my gosh, it's brilliant.
And like, I remember going to school and feeling okay because I had that story in my head.
Yeah.
And so I love obviously what you shared of like the stories that we tell ourselves around our experience have such power and such an effect on our physical health, our mental health, all of these things. And when you choose to just adjust a couple little words, it's like you wouldn't think that would have such an impact.
Right.
But you're right. I have since, you know, reading your free offering, I've done that and taken away the, oh, I can't go out to dinner, or I, you know, I really should do this, trying to use, you know, I'm choosing this or I'm choosing that. Mm-hmm. And it's so true that you start hearing it everywhere.
Yeah.
It's shocking. And uh-huh. I kind of want to, you know, give out little like cards or something. I'm like, did you know that you don't have to say can't? Did you know? I want to like, you know, distribute pamphlets or something to let people like public awareness about this because it is everywhere. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And also what you were saying about there's always this option to not do it. I think it's a Martha Beck line that corpse pose is always an option. Like in yoga, you can always just stop. That's always a choice that you have.
I like it.
You may not like the consequences, but you always have corpse pose as an option.
Yeah. And sometimes people think, well, that's silly or that's stupid. But when you really get it kind of down in your bones, like, oh, no, I actually can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
It is. It is. And actually, that also connects well with your recent free email series, which I've been geeking out about. It's boundaries.
Me too.
Oh, good, good. That's as it should be. So, boundaries for kindred spirits. And in the first email, I wrote down this line. Most of us have been taught that if you're a loving, kind, good person, you won't ever say no. That you won't ever stand in that dominion and make those choices for yourself. And you propose a new definition, which is someone who pours their energies where they matter, that that's what it means to be good. And I really love this. I gave a TEDx talk around this topic, but can you talk about why is this such a struggle, particularly for women, to be selective about how they give?
There's so many messages that come at us, you know, from the time we're very young, that tell us that we don't know what's really going on. Our judgments are incorrect. What feels true or right to us isn't actually accurate. Mm-hmm. And it rarely happens. I mean, sometimes it happens overtly and deliberately, but most of the time it just sort of happens by accident. It's not one big moment. It's these hundreds and hundreds of subtle messages that we get. It's things like, what? You don't like pizza? Oh no, honey, you love pizza. Or, oh, you don't actually hate your brother.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. You know? Or, fairly insidious is the, oh no, go give such and such relative, go give him a hug. No, come on, give him a kiss. There's no harm meant most of the time, but it's these subtle ways that we are taught to override our own sense of what is true and good for us. Mm. And when you override that, you know, it's like you have this inner guidance system, but you get taught to override it again and again and again, just in these hundreds of tiny little subtle ways. And when you override it enough, you lose access to it. Mm. And when you don't have that inner knowing or that inner like guidance system to guide you, then the only way you can really steer is by checking with these things outside. Okay, well, let me see, what does the teacher say? What does the pastor say? What does the pastor's wife say? What does the, you know, my Bible study teacher say? What does my college advisor say, right? Like, when you're cut off from that inner guidance, you have no choice but to take all this input from people around you. Mm-hmm. And one of the most prevailing kind of unconscious beliefs in our culture is that the best way to be safe as a girl, as a woman, the best way to be okay is to be nice and to mm-hmm. be good, to be kind and to share and to be loving. You know, I mean, this is not a new concept. Virginia Woolf wrote about it really compellingly in her essay, The Angel in the House. And there's sort of this idea that, you know, if you're a pretty princess and you're so kind that all those forest animals love you, eventually some hero rescuer will ride up on his white horse, right? But the way that you earn that rescue and the castle and the pretty dress and all of it, the way you earn that is by being sweet and good and kind and nice. Mm-hmm. There's actually nothing wrong with being sweet and good and kind and nice, but it's only like one little stripe of who we are. We also have fierceness and toughness and maybe even selfishness, you know, not like we have this whole spectrum of who we are, and we're mostly taught that only this one little slice of it is acceptable.
Yeah.
And if that's all you have to go on, you're kind of toast. You know, you're a little bit, you're a little bit in trouble. And so when you're taught and shown in a million subtle ways that the way for you to be okay is to take care of everyone around you, then you don't really know how to be discerning, because everyone is everyone. So you just try to take care of everything. So you say yes to every request. You do favors for people who will probably never return them. You get into agreements that aren't necessarily good for you, whether that's, you know, you sign a contract you shouldn't sign. You say yes to, you know, a proposal you shouldn't accept, whether that's business or romantic, right? Without that inner discernment, we're sort of just little lambs walking around in the world at the mercy of everything around us. Mm-hmm. So it can feel really, really scandalous and terrible and horrifying sometimes when we start to say no. And women are always like, why is this so scary? Most of us have been taught our whole lives that that's not okay. It's not safe. It's the right way for us to be in the world. So when we start to say no, it can bring up all of this kind of primal terror. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be thrown out of the tribe, whatever that means for you. But I do think that when we're just sort of, when we don't have any boundaries and we can't ever say no, then we're just sort of this like, we're like every little wind can blow us around, right? We don't have any forward direction of our own. We're just sort of like, oh yeah, you want that? Oh yes. Oh, you wanted me to be more like that? Okay. Oh, right? And we think that, that's what will keep us safe. We think that that's how we're supposed to be. But the truth is, it just means that we're kind of flailing all over the place. So when we start to say no, it can feel really terrifying. But it's like we get all those pieces of us back, and then we get to choose what we're going to do with all that energy. We have all this extra juice, and we can pour it into the things that do truly matter. We can care for the ones that we care about. We can work hard and fiercely and in a kind of an aligned way for causes that matter to us. We can put our creative juices into our own projects that we want to do. So it's not about being selfish and not caring for the people around us, but it's about doing it in a cohesive way that's in alignment, rather than just sort of spraying ourselves all over the place.
Yeah. Wow. I realized as you were talking that safety piece is not something I hear a lot about. I think that's really important. The whole idea, you know, you hear plenty about, okay, you know, I know it's hard to set boundaries, it's scary, but you can do it, and la la la. But I don't think there's very much about you will feel physically and emotionally unsafe sometimes if you start to step out of these confines that you've put yourself in. And that fear, like you said, it's what drives you back. But like specifying that as safety is really helpful to me because it gives me compassion for my past self, who was like that tree you're describing of just going back and forth of like, oh, I used to judge her as being really weak, of just, she just went with what everybody wanted her to do, and why didn't she stand up for herself? And now I'm like, she was afraid for her safety. Yeah. So it makes sense.
Yeah. And I believe that these beliefs and ideas get passed down generation to generation. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we're not even really cognizant of all the different tribal beliefs that we have kind of rattling around in us that we didn't really deliberately sign on for, but they're just kind of there. And if you think back even just a couple generations, but especially if you go back many generations, for what it's been like for women to be in the world, there were a lot of times, and there still are many times and places in our world today, where it is not safe for a woman to say no.
Literally,
it's not safe for her to go to school. It's not safe for her to say no to the, you know, whoever the powerful male elder is in her world. So it's not surprising at all. In fact, it's actually a kind of a deep wisdom, I think, that has been passed down to protect us. It's just that the world is changing rapidly, and our roles and the possibilities for us have been changing so rapidly. It's like our psyche hasn't quite
caught up.
Yeah, which makes sense, because this is the last, you know, let's say 100 years of new civil rights and liberties for women is like a tiny little like blink in terms of like the history. So we've had eons and eons and eons of repression and danger and, you know, child marriage and, you know, sexual slavery and all that good stuff. And then we come to here and we're like, okay, now instantly let's change everything. It's wonderful, but it's not surprising that it's like we have a little bit of like a jet lag almost.
Yeah. That we're like, wait, I have a lot of baggage. There's a lot of stuff over here that I haven't quite arrived at this new freedom yet.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, another thing I love about your work, I feel like you are very good at actually giving people windows into your day-to-day life and being specific about how you take these concepts and put them into action. And so what are some of the daily tools that you use to discern, to tap into your inner knowing? I know you've written about doing morning pages and that is foundational for you. So can you share a bit about your tools?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I can see my journal. It's right here. I'm just going to show it to you.
Yes, please.
So this is my journal where I write basically every morning. Not every single morning, because no one's perfect, right? But most mornings, a lot of mornings. I write here in my journal, and I use a stream of consciousness journaling technique created by a woman named Julia Cameron. And she wrote a wonderful series of books. There's The Artist's Way, and I can't remember. There's a bunch of ones sort of in that vein, but The Artist's Way, oh my God, I love that book. I love it. And she has you just write, like freehand, just literally stream of consciousness. Like, even if you're just writing, I don't know what I should be writing. This is so stupid. I'm wasting my day. Just, it doesn't matter. Just keep your hand moving for 3 pages. And then when you're done, walk away. And so it's not writing in the way that we like think about writing, where we're crafting and we're creating and we're, you know, editing as we go. It really is more like we're just dumping stuff out on the page. And I find that that is a hugely important ritual for me. And I try to do it every day. I always fail, but I always feel better when I do that. It's like, that's my like emotional hygiene. It's like I'm taking a shower for my mind and my spirit.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to spend some time in silence every day. I'm not going to be quite fancy enough to call it meditation because it's mostly just silence. Again, I don't manage it every day. And sometimes even when I try to sit quietly, my mind is racing so, so fast that it's not very, you know, successful if we were going to judge it. But I do try to spend a little bit of time in silence every day, even if it's just looking out the window with my cup of tea. And then something really practical that I do, I'm going to show you a page that I actually print out every single day. This is called my Daily Compass.
Yes.
This is one of the tools that I teach in a program called the Queen Suite, which is all about clearing your physical clutter and setting up systems to help creative people sort of corral their energy. So we look at, you know, cleaning out your closet and how you handle your money, and very like very practical. And this is one of the tools that I created for myself because I needed it, and now I show it to other women. And so this is today's Thursday, May 11th. It has my theme for this year, which is steadfast powerhouse.
Nice.
And it's a discipline that forces me to set priorities for each month, priorities for each week, and identify a priority for each day. And so this is a very practical way that I keep myself sort of on track, because I am interested in everything and very ADD, and so I can be in a million places, and that helps me sort of get everything lined up and remember, oh no, that's right, the most important thing for me to do today is this. So those are some of the ways, some of the things that I do every day, some of those kind of rituals.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm definitely one of those geeks in terms of, I love reading people like time logs. Like we, on this series, we talked to Laura Vanderkam, who's a time management expert. And she's just an amazing kind of in the field researcher of looking at how people spend their time and how do people, you know, stay focused and prioritize. So I love getting those little glimpses into, this is what I actually do, so I'm not just flying around feeling scattered.
And even to fill out something like this every month, week, and day, it's essentially, this is like my boundary around my time. This is like me saying, there's 84,000 things that I could do that might be wonderful to do, but I'm saying no to those so that I can say yes to these three. Three is sort of a good number for me. And people resist it. They're like, no, like they're all, everything is important. It's, I can't say no to anything. And I'm like, I get it. Except that when you won't say no to anything, you're sort of saying no to everything, because you're kind of gonna half-ass most things.
totally.
So I find that these very kind of practical things, like making a list in this way, really for me go hand in hand with having some spiritual presence. You know, so that like as much as I wish I was someone who like did yoga every day, meditated every day, I'm like, I'm not there. And yeah, I find that some of these really practical, seemingly humble things, even things like making my single day, whether I feel like it or not, they actually help create this space in which I can show up and be present, which for me is most of my spiritual journey is about trying to just be present instead of being all over the place.
Yes. And that's also, it's fitting that you mentioned that, because Gretchen Rubin, who is another writer that I love, talks about, of all the tips that she shares of how to be happier and how to be healthier and all these things, she said the one that the most people adapt and feel the most satisfied with is make your bed. And she thinks, you know, of all of them, really, make your bed? But I agree. It's from what you're saying. It's kind of setting a tone. It's making a statement. it's, mm-hmm. you know, it gains a greater significance.
And you start your day off with a win. Like, mm. before you left your bedroom, you've already like, yes, I am a great, wonderful success.
I nailed that. I really made that bed.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the whole rest of the day, you have that, you know, you have that visual reminder that reinforces mm. like, yeah, I can do this. I can do life. I can make my life gorgeous. Okay.
Yeah, I got this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love that you highlighted the spiritual life too, because I forget exactly where you mentioned this, but one of my favorite blog posts that you wrote was talking about this idea of why do we love books like Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings so, so much? Mm-hmm. And this idea that a deep part of us resonates with the thought that there's a magical world that runs next to ours or is within ours, but we don't see it and we don't feel it and connect with it. Mm-hmm. And so recently you wrote a gorgeous ebook, Practical Magic for Secret Mystics, that really dives into this magical world. And I'm about 3 chapters in. I'm loving it. I don't want to put it down. So could you tell us a bit more about the book and about what a secret mystic is?
Sure. Yeah. For a long time, I was searching for a term to describe my spirituality. I grew up very Christian. My parents were actually missionaries. And I knew I definitely was not a Christian. I was like, all right, I'm a heathen. That's what I am. I'm a heathen.
But right. I also, because those are your choices, Christian.
Yeah, those are my choices. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Really going up or down. Those are the only two options. I was definitely going down, but I was really happy about it.
Nice.
I was like, if between the lambs and the goats, I was definitely a goat. I was a happy goat, finally. So I was playing around with this idea of being a heathen. I was like, but the problem is, even though I am allergic to every religion I've ever tried, and I've really tried most of them, I am deeply spiritual. I have this crazy renegade belief that there is this heartbeat under everything, mm-hmm. and that we can tune into it if we want to, anytime, anywhere. And that this heartbeat, not to put too fine a point on it, that it loves us. That's something I just believe. I was like, well, I'm a heathen, but I'm also kind of this shameless mystic. So I started calling myself a heathen mystic, almost as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an idea that resonated with many of my people. Mm-hmm. And I realized that there is this whole realm that no one ever talked about, no one ever taught me about. And it was the realm of energy, of emotions, and that thing that's really hard to quantify, but you can feel it.
Yes.
You know, if someone is really, really angry and they're just, you know, even if their face is politely composed, you can just feel this seething anger in them. I don't know what to call that. Yes, you can measure some things electromagnetically, and maybe we're picking up on their heart rate, but there is this other sense that's sort of, we don't really have language for. And many of the people who I connect with most deeply in my own life are the same way. And it was sort of like, we all have this big secret, which was like, we're smart and we're rational and we believe in science and, you know, whatever, but we're also kind of mystical. And so
yes.
I started to think about like, what were the things that I wish I had known, I wish someone had taught me. And it's really, it was about how to manage this whole realm. It was like I had all these extra antenna, you know, people's feelings came through so loudly. If I was with a sad person, I would feel sad, even if I'd been happy a minute ago. If I was with a scared person, I could feel my own heart like start to pound in sympathy. It was empathy, actually, not sympathy. I was very empathic, as were so many of the women that I was working with. And I was like, oh my gosh, we have to learn to figure this out. Like, we're just walking around like Edward Scissorhands before he learns to use his own scissors.
Yes.
Like, cut yourself if you're not careful. And right, you can be weirdly sharp in the world, even when you want to be a loving force. And so I just sort of dove into this. I read hundreds of books, literally. I'm a reader. I dove into everything. And there was so much good wisdom out there, but there was also so much crap. There was a lot of just snake oil and I don't know, things that kind of posed as magical but were really quite, I think, cynical and were there just to fleece people. So anyway, I embarked on this like years long study into this kind of realm of the mystical while still really wanting to keep it very grounded and very sane and very safe. And so what I came up with were these 7 symbols. These 7 tools or practices that help you walk in the world, even if you're very open, learning to draw some boundaries and help you use those gifts of compassion and empathy and being more sensitive without just being completely overwhelmed by them. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of fun writing the book. We came up with some magical symbols that, you know, are kind of magical. There's a cloak, there's a banquet table, there's a key.
Yes.
I got to play around with this concept of that we're making magic. Well, actually, the truth is we are absolutely making magic. But it addresses some of those things that feel like they're too out there. Mm-hmm. For some people, we sort of talk about, where are you on the spectrum of being mystical and how do you stay very sane and very grounded without opening yourself up to stuff that you don't want while still embracing that you do have sort of these extra spidey senses that not everyone is talking about. So I love this material so much. It came really out of an intense desire. It's like the book that I wish somebody would have written for me. So then I wrote it for my people. I love it.
Me too, wholeheartedly. And for folks who have not yet seen it, heard of it, I will read the opening line to the main page on your website that talks about it, which is, "Can one angry person ruin your whole day?" And if your answer to that question is yes, then you should read this book because it's for you. Yes. Yeah. I remember I read that line. I was like, oh, she's got my number. Like, she knows.
I just assume that everybody was like that. I just assume like, well, it's like that for everybody. I don't know why I can't get my act together, right? Like, everybody feels this. They're just better at dealing with it than me. And it was so shocking to find out like, wait, what do you mean you don't feel other people's feelings? What? And they were like, looked at me like I was crazy. Like, no, we don't feel people's feelings. And I was like, oh, this is important information that I did not have.
Yes. When I was reading this, it struck me even now of it's bumping up against that assumption of, well, doesn't everyone feel like this? Well, doesn't everyone have this problem? And then you realize,
nope. No. Mm-mm. It turns out not everyone wants to be a writer either, which I don't understand. I thought everybody wanted to be a writer. But
yes. Yes, you had that great blog about, I think it was you and your friend were talking about your big dreams, and she was saying something about, I just want to live near a Target, and like, that was her dream, and you were like, really? You don't want to be a writer, and you don't want to, she's like, no. I was like, what?
It's like, I know you're supposed to say that, but really? She was like, no, really.
Yeah.
It blew my mind.
Yes, and that, it was such a relief to me, because it does give you that permission of, oh, you know, not everyone wants this exact thing. So maybe there's a reason that I want it. And maybe it's okay if I go after it.
Yeah. Yeah. I once heard Lissa Rankin give this great talk. She's an MD and a wonderful mystic in her own right. And she said that it was at this thing called World Domination Summit. And she said, who here has always had a deep sense from as long as they can remember that they're supposed to be here to like help heal the world somehow. Mm-hmm. And like 99.9% of everyone in the room raised their hand.
Yeah.
She said, I once asked that question at a Harvard Law School, like auditorium full of Harvard Law students. She said, no one raised their hand. Mm. She said, for a second, I was like, oh my gosh, they're all sociopaths. And then she said, no, ask a different question. You're asking the wrong question. And she said, how many of you have felt that you're supposed to help bring more justice into this world for as long as you can? Everyone raised their hand.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh my gosh, we're not all supposed to make art or go into politics or write books or teach kids or, you know, do whatever that thing is that you assume everyone wants to do. Like, it's kind of amazing. So I found that really gave me permission. I found it really empowering because it gave me permission to be like, oh, like you said, maybe there's a reason I want to do these things so badly.
You gave me chills. That was awesome. Yes, exactly. And speaking of books, you are working on a memoir or have finished a memoir. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but could you talk about
there. Mostly done, but
mostly done. Excellent. Well, yes. Can you share a bit about what it's about and what the process has brought you, what you've learned along the way?
Yeah, sure. So I wrote a book about my childhood mostly, which is a little bit unusual. I grew up in Japan. My parents are Christian missionaries. And so when I was 5, my family moved to Japan, and I spent most of my childhood there. Very much like in the church, really sort of saturated in that world. And then, as you can see now, have come on quite a journey to end up in a very different place. And so that book is just, it's that story of how I was that little girl and what it was like to grow up in a world with my terrible secret, which was that I knew I wasn't like the people around me. I didn't feel Jesus' love. I kept saying that the salvation prayer again and again and again, and I just could feel that it didn't take. So it was about what it was like to have that terrible secret and a few other secrets along the way, and how I ultimately ended up leaving the church and going on a rather unorthodox journey of healing. So right now the book is complete, but I don't have a plan to put it out in the world yet. I don't have an agent or a publishing deal or anything like that. And right now and then, I think maybe I just needed to write it for myself. Maybe I just needed to write it to come to peace with my own past. I also kind of would like to put it out in the world. So.
Totally. Wow. That's fascinating to me on multiple levels. Not only because I think we're at similar stages. I'm going through the third draft. So within the next couple of months, it will be done and ready to send out. But yeah, I have the similar uncertainty of, will this find a home out in the world? And there are moments where I definitely feel, as you have said, that maybe it's worth it that I just needed to take this journey and write it. But then there are other moments where I just feel like other people's books have been such a lifeline for me that my dream would be for this to be a lifeline for somebody else, you know, to write the book you wish you had had. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, I will definitely be first in line when your book is out there because I'm really excited to read it.
Thank you. Well, I'm not done. I'm going to keep nudging this one forward, but there's just a lot of other things happening at the same time.
Yes. Yes. And that is a hard thing sometimes, realizing, you know, okay, it's not never, it's just not right now. It's just, okay, there are other things I need to focus on. And you've had such major life changes in a relatively short span of time. You've moved, you now have 5 kids, you got married, just everything.
Yeah. I'm one heck of a year, I gotta tell ya.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the time out of this hectic year to be present and have a wonderful conversation. So
sure.
Just as we wrap up, do you have any other stories or words of wisdom that you want to share to close?
I would urge you, sort of like what we were talking about before, that if you have this secret hope, this secret dream, and you think, well, everybody wants that. You don't really get to have that. Nobody gets to actually have that. Or you're not really, you know, everyone wants to be fill in the blank. Listen to it. Give it some room. Give it some space. Treat it with some respect. It doesn't mean you're going to go tell everyone in your world. Most of them are probably not ready to hear it or the right people to even help you. But write it down in a safe place in a journal. Whisper it to a trusted friend. Trust that your longings are not terrible urges meant to take you away from your destiny or your purpose, but trust that maybe they're there to steer you towards something kind of amazing, something that maybe only you can do. And sometimes it will take you to very unexpected places.
Amen. Thank you. I needed that, and I know someone else watching out there is going to need that too, so...
I usually need to hear it myself on a basically daily basis. So I always write what I need to hear.
Totally. If I'm ever stuck or have writer's block, I do like a letter format is the easiest for me to write. So I'll pick a person. Sometimes it's a friend. Usually it's, you know, me in the past or me in 10 minutes that, okay, here's what you need to know, and just kind of lay it all out there.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I read, I think it was in a... It was a book on the Myers-Briggs framework, and I'm an INFJ, and I believe you're INFP, if I remember correctly.
INFP, yeah.
And it talked about the idea that for idealistic writers, writing to a faceless audience leaves them uninspired. But if they can write to one person, it usually turns the light bulbs on and they can do it. And that is true for me, at least, of like, if I have a person in mind.
Send love letters to someone she loved.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Well, I could talk to you all day. Clearly this, yeah, we could continue this for a long time. But I just want to say thank you so much. And folks should visit declaredominion.com to get more of Anna. And we're going to be giving away a free copy, exciting, of the Practical Magic for Secret Mystics ebook here on the blog. So awishcomeclear.com. If folks leave a comment, you will be entered to win your copy.
Yeah, and it's a book with, you know, chapters and everything, but it's also, I've created a whole program that goes with it. So there's an audio version and there's worksheets and guided meditations. And if you don't win the book, if you want some free resources that I've put together for mystics, you can go to declaredominion.com/boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
There's a secret page there with kindred spirits. So check that out.
Well, thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a treat to talk about all the things.